Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. I trust you. Everybody's spine is now aligned. It's time for Vox Pop on this Thursday, September 8th. And what a Vox Pop we have for you. This will straighten you out indeed. It's the Science Forum. We have brilliant people here. More to come. Lord knows how many scientists we can fit in this room. But, you know, do the volume of the whole thing. Probably 37 scientists, I think, in this room. And we'll try to squeeze as many in as possible. And your calls. The number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Yeah, the Science Forum. Aren't you lucky? It's coming up after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Yes, it's time for our monthly convocation of eggheads. It's the collection of brainiacs we call the Science Forum. And what a collection of scientists we have today. I'll tell you all about those in a moment. The number to call if you have a very, very difficult, arcane scientific question is 800-348-2551. Or even if you want to know why clothes smell better when they're hanging outside, it's fine, whatever. 800-348-2551. You can also email the program, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. So now it's time to meet the brainiacs, our panel of experts. Scientists, sign in, please.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist.
Oh, Ed Stander, SUNY Copal Skill. I teach geology, astronomy, and I answer the simple questions.
And I'm Barbara Brabetz, also from SUNY Copal Skill. I am a biochemist. And Ray moved us around, so we're all out of sorts.
Hey, I didn't move anybody. I came back out from taking the air out front right after the billboard, and all of a sudden the lights were changed. I believe it's Stander's fault.
I think it's always Stander's
fault. Well, actually, everything is Stander's fault, yes.
So how are things going at Copal Skill, you two? Two kids?
we're 2 weeks in, but I just wrapped up some research for the summer. We had some students and also the partner Riverkeeper working with us to look at fecal contamination in the Mohawk and the Hudson Rivers.
What's the poop?
You've been saving that one.
No.
You're
just come up with these things, yes.
He's retentive.
Well, the poop is that our water infrastructure does pretty well when it's not raining, but as soon as it starts raining, we overflow.
Grant dollars at work, eh?
We need some more.
All right, then. And what have you been doing?
Well, let's see. I'm finishing up the New York State Geological Survey is remapping much of New York.
Okay.
Apparently, the rocks have changed in the last 25 million years.
I see.
And,
that was when the last map was done?
They're still paying the bill.
We're still checking on it. And so I've just finished up the Clarksville Quad, and before that we did Voorheesville. Basically, there have been over 2,000 earthquakes in this one area around Medusa.
Yeah.
And
very small earthquakes, right?
Very small, yeah, but a lot of them. And we've been trying to figure out why that's been happening. And part of that is trying to figure out whether there's fault activity in the area. So we're mapping the area to see whether there's new fault activity.
So how does one map a fault? I know how to map my own, but how does one map a fault in the ground?
Well, we look at the rocks on both sides and see if they're offset.
Okay.
That's basically it.
Any preliminary sort of suggestion as to whether there is fault activity there?
Well, if there's earthquakes, there's probably fault activity. That makes it sort of easy.
Yeah.
So okay. We start there and we go from there.
All right, thanks, Ed. Jim, what have you been up to?
Well, I'm supposed to be retired, but only semi-retired. And since I'm a chemist, I just do boring things.
Yeah.
No one's particularly interested in.
I remember way back when my father was friends with Mr. Wizard. Mm-hmm. My father did educational TV long ago. And one year he sent my brother and I a Mr. Wizard chemistry set.
Yeah. I had one of those.
Yeah.
And those I got to come awesome. In the big blue plastic.
You can hurt yourself with those.
Well,
things.
This is what I'm saying. Nowadays, I don't think you get any of these chemicals.
You get blue stuff and pink stuff and mix it together.
Yeah.
Mr. Wizard probably made me the scientist I am today.
You see.
Yep. Remember watching that every time it was on?
Good stuff.
Wonderful.
That's where I got all the answers to the questions I had.
By taking the chemicals?
No, by watching Mr. Wizard.
Oh, very good. Well, thank you. We'll test you. Let's go to the phones now and test Ed. He's already testing my patience. Let's go to Bob in Albany. Bob, you're on.
Good afternoon, all. I was listening to one of the Strange Universe shows on WAMC, and they mentioned that larger stars can have core temperatures that are tens of millions of degrees hotter than the Earth's sun. core temperature. And that got me wondering if there's an absolute top temperature that could be theorized, if not currently calculated, and whether that would have to mean that there was also a top size of a star or a great or the largest size star, because it seems like the highest temperatures are all about the pressure of large suns on their cores. Take it away.
Well, I can comment on that a bit. I can say that even if you have a star that has a core temperature which is 10 or 100 times that of the sun, when the star collapses, the temperature goes way, way, way above that. It can go up to a billion degrees.
Wow.
So there really isn't a maximum temperature one can reach. But when you start collapsing something that's the size, for example, of the orbit of Jupiter and collapsing it down to the size of our sun, the pressures in the center and the temperatures get so high that it effectively produces all the other elements in the universe.
And that's the idea that pressure and temperature are related. If you increase pressure, you're pushing that material closer together. You get kind of a frictional force, if you will, as they get they move closer together. The atoms don't have as much space. The electrons interact, and you get strange phenomena.
So that's how a pressure cooker works.
It is a way, one of the ways how a pressure cooker works, but certainly in the sun, it's the pressure cooker.
So, but I mean, Bob's question is an interesting one. There is an absolute zero, right?
We think.
But there's no absolute top temperature before something happens.
Oh, lots happen as you're going up through
what
those
temperatures. What I'm saying is there's not the absolute ceiling on temperatures.
I mean, at some point, you
would
well, temperature becomes not well-defined anymore, I would think, because we define temperature by the kinetic energy of things,
vibrations
things
of
vibrating
those
around.
Right.
Eventually, you get to the point where those atoms and even the subatomic particles will
break down.
Mm. That's where we need a physicist. I'm not sure what temperature means at that point.
Is there a physicist in the house? No. I see Greg Hames over there, but all he knows is about his rock bands and such. Let's see. Jenny in Burlington is on. Jenny.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. So I want to know, and I can hang up when we're done, but I want to know, how is fracking and earthquakes related? I guess that's been going on in Oklahoma.
So fracking and earthquakes. And, yeah, they just upgraded the last big earthquake to, I think, a 5.8, which is pretty big.
Oh, from 0.6 to 0.8?
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right, Jenny, you want to hang up or you want to hang in there?
I'll hang up. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot. All right, panel.
Well, I'll take it again. Effectively, what happens is when you pump liquid down into a fault zone, it decreases the friction on that fault zone. It was first discovered in Denver back in the 70s when they were doing some illicit mustard gas experiments.
In the 1970s?
Yeah, and the government was pumping the liquids that they were using into the ground, and every time they pumped liquid into the ground, there was an earthquake in the area.
Hmm.
And a reporter discovered the relationship by talking to somebody, I guess, as to when they were pumping it down and when it was happening. So what you're doing effectively is decreasing what's called the normal stress, or the stress holding the rocks together, and that causes the earthquake. So
you can think of it like you've had your turkey dinner at Thanksgiving. The Tigers lost, or the Lions lost, and now you're waiting for the Dallas game, and you go to the pumpkin pie, and you put the pumpkin pie in, and you get a wafer-thin mint, and then you eat the wafer-thin mint, and your pants just blow.
It's wafer-thin.
The cohesiveness of the rocks can't overcome the stress out, and your pants bust a button.
This is interesting. Now, go ahead, Jim.
Well, I was going to say,
I have not had lunch.
That the relationship to fracking is more indirect.
So this is the return of the wastewater, or the waste fluids?
Injection wells, they call it.
I mean, in principle, fracking could do this, but that doesn't seem to be very common. What's coming from in Oklahoma is they'll take the what's called produced water, the water that's heavily loaded with brine, with salts, with stuff that comes up out of wells. And it doesn't have to be just the fracked wells. And a convenient way to dispose of that is to inject it into a deep well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that deep well injection of the wastewater that's causing the earthquakes.
Interesting.
Now, it's indirectly related to fracking, because fracking water often is disposed of in that way.
I mean, clearly there is certainly at least an indirect relationship because they didn't have so many earthquakes, or, and certainly not one 5.8 before all the fracking started in Oklahoma.
Right. So it releases the stress if you put the water in there. But even worse sometimes is if you start pumping water out, because then the ground starts to settle.
Yeah.
And then you get even more earthquakes associated with that. So, for example, around Dallas, Texas, where they've been pumping oil for years, the center of Dallas, Texas is 50 or 60 feet below what it used to be. And all around Dallas, there are a series of concentric rings, which are effectively faults as it goes towards the center.
This is from oil drilling?
That's from removing the oil from the ground.
And in Florida, the sinkholes that you hear about are the same effect of removing water, in this case, groundwater, for use. You overuse that groundwater, it doesn't get recharged, and then you've wrung the sponge out underneath the surface, and somewhere there's got to be a collapse.
And I heard that in Los Angeles, where, of course, they've had water problems for a long time, the ground is sinking there as well.
Yeah, the Imperial Valley, where your strawberries come from, is 70 to 80 feet lower than it used to be.
How long ago?
A century ago. Mexico City is by far the worst, though.
Yeah, because all the water in Mexico City comes from the ground beneath Mexico, which is why the Mexico City government keeps on telling people to drink lots of Pepsi.
So the water, the aquifers, will they recharge over, say, 1,000 years?
There's a global budget of water.
Right.
It's only as fast as the geology and our weather allows. And so the largest uncertainty is human use. So when humans overuse that, we can't make it go faster. We can't cheer on water recharge.
I saw something. Oh, go ahead, Jim.
Well, and in some of the aquifers, I know can never pronounce it correctly.
Ogallala.
Yes, that one. That goes through the Great Plains. That's, I believe, I'm speaking a little out of turn, it's called fossil water in that.
Yes.
That's something which wouldn't be recharged for tens
it's
of thousands.
It's glacial, right. It came from the last glaciers.
Yeah. And we'll have to take a break here in just a moment, but I had read somewhere recently that all the water that is on Earth was created billions of years ago.
Pretty much. We do get about 300 pounds of extra water a year.
Meteor?
Comet, dust, comets. That kind of stuff. But that's not a lot.
It is the Science Forum on WAMC. We'll take a break here. 800-348-2551 if you want to weigh in here and get your question in to this panel of brilliant people. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in European car sales and service for over 20 years. QFCC.com. Bodywork Professionals Licensed Massage Therapists. Nick Pavoldi, Advanced Structural Integration Practitioner, Proprietor. Offices in Latham and Saratoga Springs, open 7 days. Your massage and bodywork experts. Bodyworkprofessionals.com. The Arthur Zankel Music Center at Skidmore College, a cultural resource for the upstate region, providing a teaching, recording, and performance venue with rental options available. Skidmore.edu/ZANKEL. Chesterwood presents The Nature of Glass, an outdoor contemporary sculpture exhibition curated by Jim Shantz, featuring artists incorporating glass in their sculptural work. Chesterwood.org for details. And Preservation League of New York State, offering EPIP, a revolving loan program to acquire, stabilize, and restore historic buildings in New York. So our past has a future.
Hello again. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Our number is 800-348-2551. Ray Graff here, also joined today by Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett. It's the Science Forum. 50th anniversary of Star Trek, yeah?
Woohoo!
Now, you scientific types, was that an influence?
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I got most of my best jokes from Star Trek.
I talk to my phone all the time, don't you?
That's a Star Trek thing. You make a point.
Yeah.
You make a point.
Everybody wanted to be Spock, you know?
No, really?
No,
not me.
No. Who do you want to be?
Not Nurse Ratched, though, or whatever.
I want to be
Nurse Ratched. That's one flew over the cuckoo's nest.
I know. Gene Roddenberry's wife. Yeah.
Oh, really? That was Gene Roddenberry's wife?
That was the nurse.
Yeah.
Yes.
I wonder how Roddenberry took to Shatner, sort of hitting on her.
I think there was. I don't think she was the wife when she started.
Oh, I see. A little Hollywood backstory
but
from Barbara Brabets.
Yeoman. What was Yeoman?
Chapel.
Nurse Chapel.
I remember the Yeoman.
Yeoman in the miniskirt with the blonde hair. Just didn't work out for me.
You guys want to carry on? I'll just nod off here.
Okay,
let's take a call. 800-348-2551. Jesse in Greenville. Jesse, you're on.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Good.
Great. I had a question about the fault lines in Medusa. I actually used to live there, believe it or not. It's like in the middle of nowhere.
Somebody had to.
Jesse was the guy, yeah.
Yeah, I was the guy. I've never felt any earthquakes.
They're really small, though. We don't usually feel them at unless they're over a 3. Is
that
right?
Most of them are around 1 or 2. I did walk up to a fellow once who, while I was doing my looking at rocks, and the guy said, "There was a bang here yesterday." And it was an earthquake under his house.
And the,
oh,
you
really?
Could hear
very,
the rocks.
Very, very near
very
the
close,
surface?
Very near the surface and right under his house. So it does happen, but you have to be awfully close to them when they're that small. They wouldn't even rattle the dishes.
We had a larger one when I was in high school, and I was not far from Medusa. I lived in Coxsackie in high school, and there was like a 6, and there was up in Jay, I think, up in the Adirondacks.
Oh, was it 83?
Yeah, that sounds good.
I was at Plattsburgh State,
right.
And we all woke up.
Things.
We had just got into bed, and it was 5 in the morning.
I thought my mother had the washer on. It was just shaking the house away when the washer was a little out of alignment, and I totally missed it, the whole thing.
Oh, woke everybody up in the dorm. Things were falling off the roof in Plattsburgh.
Yeah, we could just feel that in Schenectady.
Yeah, if you're interested, by the way, you can go on to the Lamont Doherty website. Lamont Doherty Lamont, L-A-M-O-N-T, Doherty, I don't know what that is. But it's down in New York City, and they're the ones that are responsible for the seismic system that runs in New York State, and you can go on there and actually see where the earthquakes are and also the historical data.
Huh.
So if something happens, you can check it out.
Thanks, Jesse.
All right.
Appreciate the call, man. Let's go over to Steve in Westfield, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on.
Hi, how you doing, panel? I had a quick question. I'll leave it at that. I've been hearing some buzz about SETI recently. What's going on? What are they looking at? And what's perked their attention? Thank you, guys.
You don't want to hang on the line for a follow-up, Steve?
I will stay on the line.
Okay.
Well,
so SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, in case the listeners aren't up on that. I think it was a big radio burst. Wasn't that what we detected?
Yeah.
The Russians did a year ago.
Yeah, and I think that this was that may be what, was that the one that's in the news now?
Yes.
Yeah, it was a Russian
satellite or
something. Yeah,
yeah. So it turned out to be not a signal from space.
They usually can tell that by the direction, like the angle and at which the transmission comes in. Yeah. If it's up in our close atmosphere, then it's going to be at a different angle than if it's way out in space.
But the odd thing about this is, now this happened a long time, I think up to a year ago, the Russians first found this. Then they announced it, and within days they said, well, it's a Russian satellite. You'd think in that intervening year they would have found out what it was.
On the desk, maybe, sitting there in the paperwork, somebody just was like,
It's very strange. The whole thing is odd.
Yeah, I don't think they were taking it very seriously when it was detected.
Then why announce it? Why wait a year and then announce it?
I have no idea.
Probably because the U.S. government was wondering what it was for a very long time.
Oh, you make a point. Let's go to George in Stanford. George.
Yes, hi. I've given up on terrestrial affairs set up with human nature and started to study about physics, especially astrophysics and the quantum world. And I've been reading the dawns of that field, Hawking and Green and others. And am I understanding it correctly that matter can come into existence without a first cause? We, with our brains, our whole experience is that we look at things from a first cause on. But apparently they say in the subatomic world, things can come in and out of existence without any discernible first cause. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, things can flicker in and out, but not very much and not very long.
And they can't be very big.
That's right. So they're little tiny quantum fluctuations, and it's all part of the quantum weirdness, the fact that there's always uncertainty about everything at small enough size scales. The difference between something and nothing becomes insignificant.
Interesting.
One of the interesting things is the act of observing something that small influences what it's going to do. So think of it like if I have my students doing their homework in the classroom and I'm not there, they're going to act differently. They're going to pull out their cell phones. They're going to Snapchat. They're going to
pass the bottle. Yeah.
But then if I walk in the room, my presence being there affects their behavior. Well, just the act of observing one of these quantum fluctuations changes what they do. So then we don't know what they're doing when we're not there. And that's the uncertainty that we're talking about.
Yeah. So but it's often referred to as kind of the quantum foam, that at this ridiculously small length scale and ridiculously small time periods, it's like a foam. Things can just flicker in and out of existence all the time.
What's the size limit, and why does this not happen on a much larger scale?
Well, it doesn't happen on a larger scale because it takes too much energy.
Right.
I mean, in principle.
You can quantify the energy it takes to turn nothing into something?
Yeah, sure. E equals mc squared.
Right.
So a little bit of mass change times the speed of light squared equals the energy involved.
So
to
it takes
that.
You can have a lot of energy to make a little bit of mass.
Where's the energy coming from?
Could be coming from another universe, as far as we know.
National grid, if they're lucky.
Okay.
Well, or again, because of at the very small time scale and very small size, it just randomly fluctuates. You can't have zero.
Okay. Well, this email that came in from Ramon in Montgomery perhaps ties in with this general conversation, and then we'll get back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Ramon says, panel, since the Higgs boson is now said to decay, interact like the Standard Model for particles, this means it is a bust, yes or no? And if it was just an inflated ruse, what is it?
Oh, Higgs boson is so hard to explain on the air. Anybody want to
the
take
so-called
a stab?
God particle?
The so-called God particle.
It gives weight to all conversations.
Oh.
Hey, that's not bad.
I didn't hear about it being unstable, though.
Well, that's what Ramon says. Maybe he's wrong.
Decay is one thing. Unstable is a different thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So we will just leave that one alone. Ramon, I hope you're satisfied. Probably not. Let's go to Rich in Whitesboro. Rich.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for the call.
Sure.
I've got a rather plain question here, maybe better asked by a cook. But I bought a Panasonic microwave, and you can't see anything in it. And even with a 25, 35, I changed the wattage. And then I got an LED down focused with about 180 lumens or so, and put it and wired it in so it's nice and bright in there. I can see. As a geezer, vision kind of deteriorates. But anyway, after I put it in, I got thinking, I wonder why Panasonic doesn't do something like this. And then I was kind of worried about, well, maybe the light might deflect the microwaves and cause uneven cooking. So am I over-worried? I hope not.
You're over-worried.
I hope so.
Yep. LED puts out very little energy, in fact, much less than a conventional light bulb. The energy that it imparts is on the order of fractions of watts. So you don't have anything to worry about.
How about the light waves itself?
The light waves are
reacting with the microwaves.
Nope. They're totally different different energies of energy, of electromagnetic. So it's as
so
if you shined a flashlight.
So they wouldn't combine like a magic storm where the waves combine? Or
not at all, because they're on totally different scales as far as the energetics go.
There is a problem, though, with using LEDs and microwaves.
Well, I was going to get to that, and also you shouldn't fiddle with the light inside the Faraday cage, but go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, well, the first problem with an LED in the microwave is that LEDs need to really be in an open environment because they produce a lot of heat. LEDs do. And if you take that LED and put it in a closed environment where the heat can build up, the LED lasts for almost no time at all.
Interesting.
It'll die out. So in a microwave in particular, where you've got an enclosed environment, the LED probably will not work for very long before it has problems.
What about LED light bulbs? They seem to last a long time.
They have to be in an open cage. They have to have some way to get rid of that heat.
You'll notice the little fins that are on the bottom of the fake kind of bulbous part of the LED light bulb when you insert it into a traditional light socket.
Yeah.
That's to air it out, to let the air exchange.
They don't feel warm to the touch to me.
Okay.
If they don't, then they're probably working fine.
Well, that's because you're far away from what's called the dye where the light's coming out. The dye itself can be pretty hot.
Well, Rich, thank you for that. That was an interesting angle here.
Okay, one comment?
Sure.
Yeah, there is a fan in there first. And second, I've had it in there a long time. It's holding up fine.
Oh, yeah. Well, they'll hold up for quite a while, probably two or three times as much as a regular light bulb. But they'll still last much less time than they would if they were out in the open.
And just make sure that you put that metal piece back in front of the light bulb, between the light bulb and the actual operational part of the microwave, to maintain the Faraday cage. Otherwise, you're going to energize the light bulb in a different way.
And that'll be exciting, right?
Not so much.
All right, over to George on the thruway. George, you're on.
Yes, just a comment or a question on the water question. I've always heard the statement, and I've talked lots of kids' statement, that the water we have has been here, and it's limited. We're not getting more water, whatever. But in the process of photosynthesis, plants take carbon dioxide and water, break it down, creating sugars, the H2O6. So therefore, water has actually been taken apart, and water that existed way back at the beginning of the planet it would seem that there's water that's captured in fossil fuels, in living plant life, and things like that. So just wondering if I'm interpreting it correctly, and if you can comment on that. Thanks. I'm going to listen. I'm on my speakerphone right now, so I'm going to switch back to the radio and listen to you on the radio.
All right, 10-4. Thanks, George.
Yeah, there are all sorts of water cycles. So let's talk first about the ones with the plants taking it up. So yeah, the plants take CO2 and water and make sugars.
And give off oxygen.
And give off oxygen. Then we eat the plant and give off carbon dioxide and water.
Right.
And we take in the oxygen to do that. So that all goes round and round and round in a cycle. Similarly, now, if you take that plant and bury it down in the ground for a few million years and
even just burn it in my wood stove.
Well, yeah, and that's the short term. So you can put it down and make fossil fuel out of it. So it sits down underground for millions of years. We dig it up and burn it. And then that returns the water back to the atmosphere. So all those exist in cycles. And yeah, there's going to be a little bit of positive balance now as we're burning all of the fossil fuels. But in the scheme of things, it's a drop in the ocean.
The other thing is the scarcity really exists in our availability of fresh water. That's the big one, because we're very, very dependent on having fresh water as a species. So more than 98% of the world's water is locked in the oceans. And a good portion of our fresh water, most of our fresh water, is locked up in ice. Mm. So getting to that is pretty much off limits for now.
All right, over to Eliza in Amherst. Eliza, you're on the Science Forum. Hello.
Hi there. First of all, a shout out to science journalists and science teachers. Incredibly important. You guys are doing a great job explaining things. And science literacy is not what we would like to be in this country. My question is, I read recently about the global warming, climate change, possibly creating parts of the northern hemisphere that are colder, not warmer. And I'm just wondering if you can explain a little bit about that.
Well, part of it has to
Why that would happen.
Well, part of it has to do with the jet stream and with what's going on the West Coast. And the West Coast is making the jet stream become a lot squigglier than it used to be. And what the jet stream does to a good extent is it separates the air that's coming from the south from the air that's coming down from the north. And it meets about at the jet stream. That's what happens. Where we are in Albany used to be, we were just about on the jet stream. Mm. And as a result, we got warm stuff coming from Bermuda, meeting cold stuff coming from Canada, and we had lots of snow. But that has been moving south. And as a result, we've been getting colder weather. Last couple of years, while everyone else has had global warming, we've actually been colder than normal.
Colder and drier.
And drier.
In
because,
the winter.
That's right, because the jet stream was further south than it should be. That's why, for example, New Jersey, that doesn't know how to drive in the snow, has been suffering.
And Washington, D.C. has had, for the last two winters, more snow than Albany.
Interesting.
Yeah, because it's always important to remember the global part of global warming. That it's not going to be the same everywhere. And some places are going to get a lot hotter. Some places are going to actually cool. So
New York State actually has an Office for Climate Change, a predictor, kind of like a strategic think tank, to talk about what will weather be like in New York in the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years. And they say Virginia weather for the summer and kind of cold Montreal weather for the winter.
Yikes. Okay.
Which is fine because I like croissants.
Very nice.
So is it still current thinking that about the possibility of disrupting the Gulf Stream, which would cool Northern Europe?
So another stream besides the jet stream is the global conveyor, which mixes warm water from the equator with rather cool water coming off the Arctic ice sheet. And that it ends up going in kind of a clockwise motion from North America over to England and then down Europe and around. And so that is why England has a more temperate climate than we have in a way, because our jet stream goes out to sea pretty much right in
them.
Jersey. It kind of heads towards them, brings them the warm water from the Outer Banks. I've been to Scotland, which has palm trees growing on shore, which is like, what? This is weird. But if that global conveyor gets disrupted, either by too much of fresh water that comes off the ice sheet at Greenland, then that water will sink and it won't bring the weather and the warmth and the energy necessary for the weather patterns we're used to. So we could end up with a very cold Europe, for example, and cold England, which is what happened in the Middle Ages. We had a global conveyor shutdown of Europe, and there was a series of
the Maunder Minimum, which was with 1600, but that was connected, I had heard, to a sunspot, just no sunspots at all.
Right.
Which we've had something similar recently.
We have.
All right, let's take a break here. It's the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Barbara, Ed, Jim, and you, and we'll be back with more calls in a moment.
Support comes from Interim Healthcare, for 45 years working to help people age in place. Companion aides and nurses 7 days a week, serving the Capital Region, Columbia County, Glens Falls, and Saratoga. InterimHealthcare.com. Agricultural Stewardship Association, presenting their 15th annual Landscapes for Landsake Art Exhibit October 8th through 10th in Washington County. Opening reception October 8th, noon to 5 p.m. to benefit local farmland protection. AGStewardship.org. Ashokan Center, building community through shared experiences in nature, history, and the arts. The Ashokan Center in the Catskill Mountains, where nature inspires. AshokanCenter.org. Real Seafood Company, Wolf Road Colony, locally owned seafood restaurant and raw bar, realseafoodco.com. And Rhinebeck Artist Shops, professional picture framing and fine art materials, Rhinebeck New Paltz, and now at 793 Broadway in Kingston, rhinebeckart.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC, the Science Forum. Ray Graff here, your humble host. You at home, the number is 800-348-2551. Our guests, Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabitz. And the phone lines are loaded. John in Liberty. John, you're on.
Yes. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening to all of what's been saying. It's very informative, and some of it I know, some of it I don't know, and so on. But something hasn't come up. And now you're talking about water. The thing that I heard this several years back was the amount of water that's trapped under the Sahara in the Sudan area, the southern Sudan area. That surprised me, the size of Massachusetts, but it's too costly to drill and to pump out of there. And also the political situation has been a deterrent as well. My question is, how much of that Sahara can we consider to have trapped water underneath it? Since thousands of years ago, before the Earth changed its axis, you had rainfall in the Sahara, you had a semi-tropical or a tropical environment. All that rain that went in there, I believe, would be under the surface, and since there's no great population there to divest it, from its subterranean reaches, it should still be there. Am I right or wrong?
Well, I can tell you a couple things. First of all, they've done a lot of drilling in the Sahara, and except for areas around oases, and they found very, very little water that they could use. In fact, just to give you an example, Saudi Arabia has been buying land up in Arizona because they can grow crops. They're not allowed to grow, for example, alfalfa, which requires a lot of water, in Saudi Arabia. Mm. So they're going to Arizona and they're pumping the water out at incredible rates to grow crops there because they can't get enough in the Sahara.
And their horses demand the best alfalfa.
That's correct. Now, another thing that's happening is that in the Mediterranean Sea, off the coast of the Sahara, they have found wells, they have found springs of fresh water coming out. Huh. So the water is getting out at places. Now, the question is, can they tap those? Can they use them on the surface? Because that's where they seem to have the most water.
Mm. It's very interesting. I wonder if the press is fully cognizant of what you said about American water going to foreign powers.
I can tell you that in Arizona, I'd read an article about this, that the ranchers there think the Saudis are just wonderful.
Because they pay them a lot of money for the alfalfa.
Land. That's right. But they're not thinking about the fact that they're taking all their water.
Can't eat money and we can't drink it.
That's
true. You make a point.
There was a documentary on Discovery Channel called Killing the Colorado, which ran in the first week of August. And you can get it streaming on the Discovery Channel website. And it talks specifically about the commerce of water and how those that do not but have money will take the resource from us in the same way that we used to be mined as colonies for our tobacco and gold.
Yeah. Over to Wanda in Longmeadow. Wanda, you're on.
Hi. This seems like such a mundane question compared to all the others. But some family members are giving me a hard time and teasing me because I use fluff containers, hard plastic containers, to freeze things in.
Okay.
Because they're just the best, sturdiest containers, and they sit on the edge of my freezer. And they say this is unhealthy.
We reuse, I use all sorts of containers that put stuff.
Were they originally food containers before you used them?
Marshmallow fluff.
Oh, marshmallow fluff.
Sure. Oh, delicious.
We didn't know what you meant.
Yeah. No problem.
No.
It's a New England thing, maybe.
Oh, no. We love the fluff. I love the fluff, yeah.
No. There's no problem with that.
Yeah. Plastic that's rated by the FDA for food use is okay to reuse, again, as long as you don't heat it beyond the boiling point of water. So, of course, freezing is not a problem.
So is that why they think it's dangerous to use plastic over and over again? Because if you heat your food in plastic, it may impart.
There's a lot
of
almost all of that kind of plastic contains small amounts of stabilizers. And for food contact, all that has to be FDA approved. And the kinds of additives which go into most of this stuff are things that don't hurt you. As a chemist and have worked in plastic stuff forever, it's not something I worry about. There are a lot worse things to worry about than trace amounts of antioxidants coming out of your plastic.
Well, Wanda, thank you for that.
What about putting plastic in a microwave?
If it's primarily a water-based food, so if you're reheating something that's frozen in a water base, it doesn't have to be a lot of water, but just water, you're fine. It's the very, very greasy things that you don't really have a lot of water. Like, you really shouldn't cook bacon on plastic because you're going to raise you're going to raise the temperature up quite a bit. And that just may start to melt the plastic a bit.
Okay. Jim in Springfield Center. Jim, you're on.
Yes, I was wondering, regarding the fracking and the pressurizing of the wastewater, we were talking about pressurizing things earlier. Does that increase the temperature of the water enough to make the rock formations below the surface of the earth expand and maybe create some of these tremors we're feeling?
No. Water. First of all, it's really hard to compress water to any great extent, and you're putting it under pressure down there, and that's allowing the rocks to expand apart. But you're not actually changing the temperature of the water as you're pumping it in.
If you do, it's just not
very minimal.
It's hot to the touch, but not.
Well, it's already
crazy.
Warmer down there.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Right.
There you go, Jim.
Okay.
Thank you for the call. We appreciate it. Francis in Adams. Hello, Francis.
Hi. I've got a question that's kind of tough to ask.
Oh, good.
Back in the 17th and 18th centuries, the various towns here in Berkshire County plotted different pathways for where roads should go. And those plots are recorded in some books, I think, at the Registry of Deeds in Pittsfield. They would record, like, starting at such and such a point, north 19 degrees, west 50 rods,
right,
and then continue that along the way. The pathways for these roads would be something like 64 feet wide. My question is, is there anything wrong with the instruments that I used, or with magnetic field getting stronger or weaker, that would not allow these pathways to be reestablished? In other words, go back with the surveying group and find out exactly where the town said they should run. The reason I ask this is because sometimes the road that would go in these pathways would be closer to one side or closer to the other. And today, they use the middle of the road to decide, where the towns own the road. And people that abut the road, some people are getting a bonus and some people are getting gypped because the road often was not in the middle of that pathway.
Okay.
So again, is there anything wrong with the equipment that they used, or inaccurate, or did anything happen that would make it impossible to decide where those pathways ran?
All right.
Well, the big change between the 1700s and now is the magnetic orientation of the North Pole. The North Pole in the 1700s was in the middle of Canada, and now it's part of Russian territory. So the direction would be completely off unless you corrected for the amount of declination of the magnetic North Pole.
The magnetic field is getting a little weaker too, right?
Not terribly.
No,
the birds are still figuring out how to go.
But that's good.
But the as far as the direction is concerned, it's changed enormously. Right now in Albany, we're about 12 degrees off from magnetic north, and back then we were more like 32 degrees off.
Interesting. All right.
So the directions are different.
Jeff in Rosendale is next. Jeff, you're on.
Good afternoon, folks. Hi, Ray, everybody.
Hi.
I'm a music educator, and when I teach kids about music, I like to start from the basics. So we talk about sound waves and how they're propagated and how they get through to your ear. And I usually show them water waves as an analog, because you start to visualize with air. And after I spent the whole summer doing this, I'm realizing that I don't have any concept of how radio waves travel through space, being that there's no medium for them. It may be a very simple question to you, but it just dawned on me that I really don't grasp that at all.
Well, light doesn't need it, right?
Well, and radio is light.
Yeah.
But that's hard for people to really take in.
Yeah, it's almost impossible, actually, to get your mind around it. It's easy to talk about magnetic fields and electric fields, but it's very difficult to grasp what that really is. I mean, when you push two magnets together, there's clearly something that's there, but it's not anything that our senses can make any meaningful interpretation of. So in a way, you just have to kind of give up and accept it, that yes, there's something there and I have no idea what it is.
Right. Well, we're just
using the term waves so that we can discuss it, but they're not actually waves.
Yeah.
No, they are waves. They are
waves in...
They have heights and everything else.
Yeah.
In an electric and magnetic fields. Now, what those fields are is what, when you start breaking that down, we have no way to sense that. We can't interpret what that means.
Well, think of just plain old go out and stand in the sunlight, and then you put on a pair of polarizing sunglasses. What those polarizing glasses do is they remove through a filter an enormous amount, quantity, of the light waves that are oriented in the wrong direction. Let me put it that way. So think of it as riding a haystack up and a haystack down, a haystack up and a haystack down. And the polarizing film only allows lights that are oriented in space top to bottom to come through and hit your eyeball. So you take the intensity of that light away. Now, they tint them, but they don't have to tint them so that they appear to work for you. But you can have a polarizing lens that really doesn't have any color change at all. And what you're doing is you're eliminating those light waves that are not oriented in the right direction. So light, Roy G. Biv light, is just like radio, only a little bit more intense. We can't see it, but there are animals that can that are sensitive to radio waves in the same way that we're sensitive to light.
There you go. By the way, this just handed to me. There is a severe thunderstorm warning for Montgomery and Fulton counties beginning at 2:52.
Ugh.
And going till 3:52. So the National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for Montgomery and Fulton counties until 3:52.
So get your questions in right now.
You're scoring
at
home.
I got to get home and close my windows.
All right. Gary in Gloversville. Gary, you're on.
Yes. I just had a want to talk about the LEDs they were talking about earlier. They were saying that LEDs put out a lot of heat, but I think it's more like LEDs really don't put out a lot of heat for the light output. What they meant was LEDs are sensitive to heat, even though they do put out a lot of heat.
Barbara's shaking her head, Gary.
They are right. You are right that the intensity, the lumens of light put out for the amount of heat that they give off is much more to the advantage of more light, less heat. But
that's why there has to be extra cooling in an LED light, just because they are sensitive to heat.
No. Well, they are sensitive to heat, but they still put out heat quite a bit. I mean, they're little tiny things, and they're still putting out.
Well, yes, they put out heat, but for the light output, they do not put out a lot of heat.
True, that's a percentage, right? But the absolute amount of heat put out is still pretty substantial.
Yeah,
Ray is feeling his light.
Very nice and cool. I got to tell you, these lights in the studio are cool.
But Gary's making a good point in the sense that just like an incandescent lamp gets really, really hot.
Yeah.
But it can tolerate that temperature. If you can close up an LED, it would get real hot and then it would die.
Mm. Right. You would. So that's basically what it is. They're sensitive to heat.
Yeah.
But for the light output, when you take a bulb, LED bulb that's equivalent to a 60-watt incandescent bulb, the bulb is a lot cooler, and that's why they're telling everybody to put LEDs in your house, because they do not burn a lot of electricity.
Well, they're much more efficient because they're producing less heat for
the
amount of light.
They're more efficient, and as far as the amps, the current, there's a lot less current that an LED uses compared to an incandescent bulb.
Right. My only comment was that if you take an LED and put it in a closed container, then it's unable to dissipate the heat that it's producing, and as a result, its life expectancy decreases from 25 years to a year.
Now, as these LEDs have propagated throughout homes, and we use a lot of them in my house now, and it cuts the electric bill substantially, are we finding that some people are more sensitive to the fluctuations, the vibration, not the vibrations.
The flicker.
My wife, very sensitive to that.
The flicker, especially with dimmers, because they haven't really been engineered quite well to be able to take the AC current that comes through a dimmer, like a dimmer switch. So some people much more so.
It doesn't bother me, though. That's the fun. I mean, when we started with the Christmas lights for the tree a few years ago, when I think they were more primitive and they flickered more.
Yep.
But I never bothered me.
I couldn't take it either, and I had to really go and stay somewhere and see that they had LED under counter lights in the kitchen before I could say, okay, I'm willing to invest and the $40 to stick those under the counter, because it would have driven me nuts if they just stared and flickered at me the whole time.
They are getting better, too.
I think they're much better now. I don't know, the electronics
that are changing.
Have they changed the color temperature? The whites are much more warm. Yeah. They seem warmer now.
No, they go all the way from 2300 to 6500, depending on what you're looking for, degrees Kelvin.
You can even now get a sunlight approximating LED. So if you have seasonal affective disorder, you can even have an LED instead of an incandescent bulb.
Can you grow plants?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Are you getting a wide enough spectrum to do that?
Yes.
They actually have spectrum lights which are red, green, and blue combined to give a good white light for growing.
Well, that's terrific. Mm-hmm. Well, this has been a fun show. Very good.
Glad to hear.
What's the latest on the fecal Hudson study? What's next?
We're doing it again end of September, and we'll do it in October and November, until they kick us out of the river.
All right, everybody. So flush twice. Barbara's doing
some more.
Don't
flush twice.
Ed, nice to have you here.
Yeah, it was really fun. I enjoyed it.
Jim, always the voice of reason. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be here.
He's the voice of reason.
Well, you're the voice of treason. Yeah. Support comes from Shannon Rose Design, Saratoga Springs, New York, working to help companies and organizations express their identities through corporate branding, web design and development, and graphic design for almost 3 decades. ShannonRose.com. Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Over 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more. Harold's.com. The University at Albany Theater Program, helping to produce theater and theater professionals for the 21st century. Albany.edu/theater. And Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts. Quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires. Ashfieldstone.com. Thanks again to Barbara, Ed, and Jim for being here. Thanks to you for listening and for all the great calls. Zach Malloy was our engineer. Your phones were answered. Who answered? Oh, Deb Malik today? Yeah, you answered the phones. Nice to have you here. I just see you behind the book. Jessica Marshall, our producer for One More Day. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Food Friday. News is next.